From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
It is my great honor to open this, the 70th session of the General Assembly of the United Nations.
That was the new president of the General Assembly of the United Nations, former Danish Foreign Minister Mogens Lykketoft, as he began his term serving at the helm of the 70th session of the organization, which kicked off Tuesday with a call for the group's 193 members to tackle a number of pressing global concerns. Maria Carlino filed this report.
The newly appointed president called on the UN General Assembly to make groundbreaking decisions during its current session to tackle pressing global concerns. Mogens Lykketoft said the new Sustainable Development Agenda world leaders are expected to adopt at the UN next week is a welcome gift to a world beset by crisis, inequality, and violent extremism.
It raises hope of the United Nations being fit for purpose and committed to action. The challenge now and the major priority for my presidency is to ensure that all actors move swiftly to deliver on the promises being made. The summit, of course, marks only the beginning. There is an urgent need for action right across the three pillars of the UN and ample opportunities to do so during this session.
Mr. Lykketoft said nations must work together to end the war in Syria, address the escalating refugee crisis, and protect the human rights of all people fleeing war. The new president also stressed the importance of adopting a strong global climate agreement and of strengthening the UN's role and performance in peace and security. Maria Carlino, United Nations.
One of the most pressing problems facing the organization has also been one of the most vexing ones: the war against the Syrian government that's being waged by a number of groups, including the U.S. and its NATO allies, and a wide range of terrorist organizations, including Al-Qaeda and the so-called Islamic State. That war is generally recognized internationally as a primary force behind the widely reported refugee crisis in Europe. Nevertheless, Washington seems more concerned over Russia's apparent intent to bolster support for the Syrian government, the only major force standing in opposition to the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition spoke about this with Press TV's Hassan Kavatoli Tuesday.
Syria and Russia, and before Russia, Syria and the Soviet Union, have had a long-standing military relationship. And it's not something new. There's an invention some of the corporate media that says this is some dramatic change that's taking place. Well, in fact, if we really look objectively at the situation, aside from the falseness of these claims, it is the government of Syria and those who are backing the government of Syria who are fighting against groups, deplorable, terrible groups like ISIS, Daesh, Al-Qaeda in Syria. And they are the ones who are really defending Syria against a complete breakup. And it is the result of the intervention of the United States, its European allies, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Jordan, and others, that Syria is in the terrible state that it is in today, where the country has been torn apart and where millions and millions of people, probably half the population now, it's unbelievable what has happened to Syria, have been forced into exile, have been displaced under the worst of all possible conditions.
For more on that, we spoke with Dmitry Babich, who's a journalist with the Russian news agency Sputnik. We spoke with him via Skype from Moscow Wednesday. So they opened the 70th session of the General Assembly yesterday. There are a gazillion things before the world, starting with at least two dozen wars, a dozen of them involving the UN directly, a refugee crisis generated by that, and other issues, global warming, famine, etc. And the most vexing problems, like Yemen, Ukraine, and Syria, seem to have absolutely, caught no attention whatsoever, really, of the international body as far as the Security Council goes. What do you think is going to happen with the General Assembly?
Well, I think it's really unfortunate that the UN has become so politically correct and so sterile, I would say. I don't think this is what its founders wanted it to be like. But, you know, when the General Secretary Ban Ki-moon announces that we're going to have a summit on migration, you know, several weeks after the crisis started, that shows how quick the UN is in its responses to the crisis. But in general, I mean, the UN cannot be better than the whole world. You know, when you have a situation when Saudi Arabia is bombing Yemen and suddenly dozens of countries support Saudi Arabia, including the United States, or when you have Poroshenko, a president who came to power by a violent coup, coming to the United States and Canada after at least 3,000 or 4,000 people were killed in his own country, mostly by his own troops. He comes to the United States or Canada and gets their standing ovations. Okay, well, what can you expect from the UN in this kind of situation? It's a world that has gone mad. And the UN is just a reflection of this insanity.
Yeah, and its structures, unfortunately, lend itself to that as well. And with an interesting twist, back in the post-war period when the United States was organizing, along with Great Britain, a Cold War against the Soviet Union, and they were planning, actually, as we saw in an article in Sputnik last month that showed some documents released by the U.S. government, that they were planning an atomic war on the Soviet Union, and it was only because the USSR blew off its first nuke before they had finished building the weapons that were going to do this, that didn't happen. But they were accusing the USSR of using its veto power, you know, in an unconstructive way and too often. And now the shoe is on the other foot, with the U.S. using it to obstruct places like Israel and Yemen, everybody knows that, and anywhere else. And that kind of touches the same tone as an article you just wrote where about Comintern and the accusation that Russia is trying to build another
destabilize Comintern. Destabilize other countries.
Yeah. While the United States, in fact, is doing precisely what it used to accuse Comintern of doing, which, in fact, Comintern didn't do.
Well, I can tell you that the United States now looks like the early Comintern, the early Communist International, which was really a pretty aggressive organization, stirring revolutions in places like Hungary and China. And, you know, believe me, in modern Russia, the Soviet Union is not idealized. We know a lot of sad truths about it, but you are right, and you don't need to go to Sputnik, sputnik.com, to find it out. You can actually learn it from the American sources that indeed a nuclear war against the Soviet Union was planned in the United States and in Great Britain in the late 40s. This is certainly true. Until 1953, there were plans for such a war. But I think right now the situation is even more dangerous because there are more nuclear weapons. And the UN is becoming more and more like a powerless body. I mean, the United States, Great Britain, and from today, even Australia, they are bombing Iraqi and Syrian territories without consent from the Security Council of the United Nations, without agreement, you know, without the consent from the Syrian government, which they openly say they want to topple. And no one is protesting. No one is paying attention to that. Instead, all the eyes are on Russia. Russia has been accused of trying to build an air base in Syria. You know, the U.S. media reports it as a fact, you know, that Russian soldiers are already in Syria. The Fox News accuses Russia of trying to occupy Syria. And you know, the question is, when the Pentagon releases satellite pictures and says, okay, these are Russian crews on Russian tanks coming to that airfield, my question is, from a satellite, how can you find out the ethnic origin of the tank drivers? How do you know these are not Syrians but Russians?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the amount of baloney which the Western media is feeding to the people worldwide, unfortunately, not only to the Western people, right, is just exceeding all limits. And sometimes it's really bizarre because, for example, in the Daily Telegraph, I have a headline, I read a headline, Putin acknowledges Russia's military involvement in Syria. So my heart breaks, you know, oh, Jesus, we are moving into Syria. And then I read the article in Vladivostok 2 weeks ago. Putin indeed said that we provide military technical assistance to the Syrian government, but we are not going to send troops there.
Right.
And what do they do? You know, okay, if you provide weapons, if you sell weapons, that means that you are militarily involved. They put it as a headline, and people who have little time, you know, just skimming that newspaper over there, morning coffee, they think, oh, Jesus, Putin said they're already in Syria. Huh?
And not only that, they bury it in the article. So even if you give the article itself a scan, it doesn't, you know, you don't pick that fact up, if they mention it at all. You know, one of the things that gets me about it, to show how naked this stuff is those same satellite imaging, machines that they have that can tell supposedly the ethnic origin of somebody sitting in a tank, can't seem to find Daesh as it moves across the desert in a fleet full of new Toyotas, for example.
And somehow the so-called Islamic State is armed with American weapons. How come?
How did that?
Very easily, you know, because most of these weapons were supplied either by the West itself or by Saudi Arabia and Turkey to the so-called secular Syrian opposition, which turned out to be not very secular and cracked up to be a part of the ISIL later.
Right.
And the other part was taken in Iraq, you know, where the brave, democratic, U.S.-supported Iraqi government turned out to have a very disloyal army, which just ran away when the Islamic State started advancing.
Or joined.
And we have fed all of that. You know, the only explanation how all of these media shamelessness can be explained is, you know, the morals of the Comintern. You know, the Comintern said that anything that serves the purposes of a revolution is moral. So in the same way, the United States and the European Union seem to have the same kind of ideology right now. Anything that serves the aims of the revolution in Ukraine, in Syria, in Libya, everything is moral. Poroshenko can bomb East Ukrainian cities. This is not against the law. This is nice. He is defending himself from Russia. The United States can bomb the Syrian territories without consent from the Syrian government or from the UN. Again, this is fine. You can topple the government in Libya and you can seize the Libyan government's bank accounts in other countries and give it to the Libyan opposition. Right. Even during the World War II, people did not take other people's bank accounts in Switzerland. That was sacred.
Right.
Now they do it.
It's true. And another one, the one that's most remarkable to me is the deal that was brokered in Yemen. There's a major humanitarian crisis in Yemen with more than half the population without food, water, and medical supplies. And that's been for several months now. And you can't go without food and water for several months and continue to survive. But there was an agreement reached at the United Nations with Saudi Arabia to allow access for humanitarian aid. And instead, the Saudis have maintained and continue to blockade and threatened or actually attacked some of those trying to deliver aid. And the United Nations Security Council says nothing.
Well, my only hope is the judgment of history, because, the United States and the EU now, they say, oh, Russia did not apologize for Stalin's crimes. Okay, Stalin died about 62 years ago, but Russia did not apologize. Well, first, Russia apologized back under Gorbachev. The Soviet Union apologized for the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. It apologized for the repressions inside the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe. So this is not true.
Well, actually, even Khrushchev.
But what about? But what about apologizing for what the United States and Saudi Arabia are doing right now?
Right.
Not a generation ago, not a year ago, not 2 years ago, but last week, you know, last hour.
Right.
There are so many people killed or left without food in Yemen. The United States has been killing people in Yemen using drones for several years. And there was never so much as a word sorry coming from President Obama, you know, saying, okay, we killed the terrorists, but sorry for killing so many civilians or this or that civilian. You never hear that. He only expects Russia to apologize for something that Stalin did 75 or 70 years ago.
The U.S. Is, of course, the heads of state are going to be making their presentations at the United Nations. There has been, I don't know if it's a qualitative change, but certainly a quantitative change in towards multipolarity over the last year or two, particularly some large business deals that were done between Russia and China, the setup of and the maturing of some of the organizations like the SCO, the setup of the AIIB, and some of those others. And there's also been a more assertive foreign policy, both from Russia and China, which is very interesting, because China has before been very demure on the world stage, more interested in doing business than in influencing events around the world, and they seem to be stepping up. Do you think the presentations that are made by, say, the BRICS countries and some of the others that are allied, like the ALBA countries, even the African Union, might start to take some sort of cohesion as an alternative to the to the global hegemon?
Well, I think that certainly we're seeing that movement, and it's not because the Chinese leaders or the Russian leaders are such nice people, you know. If given a chance, they would probably continue, Russia would continue just supplying oil and gas to the European Union, living off that. China would continue doing business with the United States, providing basically cheap labor for the U.S. companies and feeling fine about it. But the problem is that the elites in Russia, in China, and to a lesser extent in Africa and Latin America, they are simply left no choice. The problem is that even the most loyal regimes are pressured and intimidated by the United States. I can give you an example. You know, the small Caspian nation of Azerbaijan, a small Muslim former Soviet republic with about 6 million in population. You know, Azerbaijan has been supplying oil and gas to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars to Europe and to the United States without any problem. You know, they have done everything as the EU wanted. They quarreled with Russia as the EU wanted. And now Europe is suspending all cooperation with them on the parliamentary level because they don't like the fact that the president of Azerbaijan is the son of the former president, Heydar Aliyev. And the problem, and again, all of these issues about gay rights, which are supposedly not observed, as if, you know, Europe started observing these rights 100 years ago, and not just a few years ago.
Right.
So they want a Muslim nation to change drastically in a matter of months, not even years. And if they don't do it, they say that we are going basically to isolate you, to make you poor, or even to put you in jail. So in this situation, the elites in China, in Russia, in India, in Latin America, in Africa, they simply have no choice but to become more active and to oppose this kind of pressure. President Putin just yesterday spoke to the so-called Collective Security Treaty Organization in Dushanbe. You know, that's in Tajikistan, Central Asian Republic.
Right.
And this used to be a very, very, uneven forum. Former Soviet republics are indeed independent. President Yeltsin got a lot of critique from them at these kind of forums. And now they all listen to Putin and they all agree when he says that sanctions against countries imposed without the approval of the United Nations are illegal. When he says that we don't want interference into our own affairs via the so-called NGOs, which are not NGOs, but which are actually Western-financed government organizations aimed at destabilizing our political systems. And they all agreed. They all agreed for the first time in 25 years. So I think there is indeed, as the pressure from the United States and from the EU is growing, there is more and more resistance to that pressure. I hope that the result will be the victory of, the defeat of the hegemon. That's how I put it, because world history knows several examples when elites in certain countries, sometimes very developed ones, decided to become world hegemons. We remember revolutionary France and Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte, who wanted to be the emperor of the world. We remember Hitler's Germany. Also, you know, unfortunately, the Nazis took hold of one of the most developed and the most scientific nations in the world. And they were all defeated. Why? Because when they started to subdue the whole world, all the other elites consolidated against them. But now it's a tragic situation because right now, unfortunately, the aggressor, you know, the hegemon, managed to rally behind him, the most civilized nations of the earth with great history and great achievements in many areas. So the hegemon managed to ally North America and Western and Eastern Europe behind him. Well, that will be difficult to resist this kind of hegemon, but history shows that the hegemon will lose.
Yeah. Let me ask you something. The United States in the post-war period and all the way up until 1991, it wanted to restore capitalism in Russia, and it wanted to put an end to the Eastern Bloc, the Warsaw Pact, and it wanted access to Chinese markets, it wanted capitalism in China, and it wanted to benefit from the labor market there. And it accomplished all of those things, whether it accomplished, those things were accomplished in one way or another. Why is it that they can't sit down and say, great, now we can make some money, or whatever it is that they were aiming at that point, and instead are continuing to fight the Cold War? What's driving that?
Well, this is the question that that has plagued the Russian elite since the end of ages, because rationally speaking, you know, if the U.S. authorities, if the U.S. elite and the EU elite, if they had been rational, that's what they should have been doing, you know. They should be just pumping oil and gas out of Russia, pumping cheap labor out of China. You know, the local elites would gladly agree to this kind of distribution of labor, if we put it in such a mild way. Right. But the problem is that, as the Bible says, when the God wants to punish someone, he deprives that person of reason. You know, when you get super profits, you want more super profits. And you can't survive if your profits don't grow exponentially, like, 20 or 25% every year. And this is exactly what happened, because the United States could get a lot more money from the Middle East if it didn't topple Saddam Hussein and other regimes in the Middle East, which might appear terribly stupid and irrational for an outsider, but they were finely tuned for the society, for those societies, certainly better tuned than the regimes which the United States installed later on. The same thing about the Soviet Union. You know, the Brezhnev might look stupid and aging and inefficient, but somehow the Soviet Union was building factories with the young and mad Saakashvili. Georgia doesn't build factories. No. You know, it is just selling the old Soviet property. It is making money on the transactions with land. It tries to cater to tourists, but it quarrels with Russia, which is the main potential source of tourists for Georgia. So, in fact, you know, the elites which the United States and the EU put in place instead of the old ones, they're almost worse than the old ones, because they're installed by outsiders, by unprofessionals, if you want. This unfortunately continues. So when people say, oh, the United States is just pursuing its interests in Ukraine or in Syria or in Libya, no, it is not in the interest of the United States to have a war between Ukraine and Russia. It is not in the interest of the United States to ruin the lives of Syrians and Libyans. It is just a terrible ideology, very similar to the one that pushed the early Comintern, which is destroying people, but destroying people for no profit of other people.
In its wake, Comintern, where it was successful, for example, in Hungary, left a socialist government, a communist party government. This particular version of neo-Comintern brings fascism when you're lucky enough to have a government in the aftermath. Places like Libya, of course, and much of Ukraine and Syria. I mean, Syria still has a government, but it doesn't control it. Iraq, places like that, they're not even lucky enough to have a functioning government at the end. What, is this just some sick progression of history, a deterioration of it as it progresses? What the hell's going on?
Well, you're right that, you know, the Soviet Union was successful, or the Comintern was successful in bringing about a revolution in Hungary in 1918. But let's remember what happened afterwards. Right. You know, the regime which Béla Kun installed in Hungary was so bloody and so inefficient that as a result, the Hungarians got disillusioned in communism.
That's right.
And later on, Horthy allied himself to Nazi Germany.
That's right.
And Hungary was one of the most anti-communist East European countries after 1945. So the result of that successful revolution of Comintern was actually quite painful to Russia, which was the main carrier of Comintern values. In the same way, I'm afraid that these so-called revolutions, which the U.S. authorities managed to produce in places like probably Libya or Ukraine, the result will be growing anti-Americanism. Just wait. And people in Ukraine will start blaming. They're already blaming a lot of their misfortunes on regular Americans, which, to my mind, do not have any relation to this misfortune which has befallen Ukraine. It's just their own ideology. You're right. Unfortunately, you know, the new Comintern is certainly more cruel and more cynical than the old Comintern, because this Comintern is ready to ally itself to people whom even Trotsky or Zinoviev would call reactionaries. You know, the terrible Muslim fundamentalists in Syria. You know, the ISIL did not spring up out of nowhere. The Islamic militants, or plainly speaking, terrorists, have been fighting Assad since the year 2011, since the beginning of these so-called peaceful demonstrations. If you look at the explosions in Damascus, it was the same style, the same handwriting as in neighboring Iraq during the American occupation, and the same people probably did it. But the United States stopped short then of really condemning these explosions, especially when they targeted the Syrian generals. Because, you know, we know the logic of Comintern. A death of a communist is a misfortune. A death of a non-communist is a blessing from the heaven. In the same way, the United States is always making a lot of noise when a pro-American journalist is killed in Chechnya or in Dagestan, you know, the two Muslim areas in Russia. But if you look at the ratio, how many soldiers, officials, school teachers are killed for every pro-Western journalist or pro-Western human rights activist at that area, you'll see that the ratio is about 1 to 1,000. And these 1,000 people, they don't arouse any emotions in Washington or in Brussels, because these are like pagans to Christians. If they die, okay, it's a little sad, but it's not even worth five lines in a newspaper. But if our person is killed in Chechnya, oh, that's a misfortune. And certainly Putin is to blame, and we are going to raise hell about it, and we are going to bring Putin to the Hague about it. You know, the same logic as with the Comintern in 1920s.
Dmitry Babich, thank you very much. Pleasure as always.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.